and become part of strategy teams and do action planning and take direct action, because women bring a very different element to direct action than to men.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of additionally, I think the way that women are perceived taking direct action is that they can, it's a lot easier for men to be seen as being egotistical or troublemakers or the sort of gung-ho macho types, whereas when women take direct action, it has a different impression on the general public and the media in terms of it's often very surprising to the general public when you see a lot of young girls doing something, putting their bodies in the way and risking their kind of personal safety, as it might be perceived, to stop something that they think is wrong. So it has a different power to just men taking direct action.
Yeah, definitely. Although I think there are sometimes some concerns with regards women's roles within affinity groups and in doing direct action. Sometimes women feel like they're not being given enough credit or aren't important enough within these groups. What do you think about that sort of issue? Do you see a solution to it or something that can be resolved?
I think it's an issue. I don't know really where it's come from in terms of whether it's something that, you know, we as activists automatically assume that the men involved in things, possibly because they're louder or possibly because more confident type people, that they are perceived to be the people that are doing all the work. And I think certainly Plain Stupid has also been subject to this feeling, particularly in the media, where Plain Stupid's men have been perceived to be doing all the work and being the leaders, as it were, even though it's leaderless. Meanwhile, when the women are sort of talked about in the media, they're talked about with a very different tone, and the things that are said about them are very different. So, for example, the Houses of Parliament action that Plain Stupid did, the men on the top of the Houses of Parliament were talked about in terms of their, their background, their history, their parents. One of the women was referred to as a fiery lesbian. It was very much about her sexuality and very much about the fact she was pretty, and that was true for both of the women that were up there. So it's just interesting the way that they're perceived, and we sort of, as women, need to challenge that.
Yeah, of course. And what do you think the place is for women-only affinity groups within direct action?
I feel they can be a very positive thing, but I also feel that in a way they're a stepping stone to mixed groups, in the sense of women can become more confident in an all-women space if they don't feel confident in a mixed space. But I also feel that ultimately we're not aiming... I feel personally that I'm not aiming to do direct action in all women's space. I'm aiming to take shit hot direct action, and if women should feel empowered while taking shit hot direct action, and if that means being in a women's space first, then so be it.
Have you done any sort of women only direct action or actions that have been, you know, primarily women organized?
I've been involved in one, and actually it's very, like, even that, thinking back to it, the fact that people referred to it as an all-girl action and kind of made, like, sexual kind of remarks about it, is really telling of how, and it, you know, even we as activists, even though we're joking most of the time, how we perceive women doing direct action. It ended up being an action with, I think it was 8 women and 1 bloke, and we were all super glued to the front of the Department for Transport. And as a result, we were all arrested and charged with criminal damage. And I tell you, the thing that was very interesting for us is how the police responded when they arrived. And actually, they didn't suspect us, because we were women, of doing anything troublesome. So it's very easy for us to get all the way into position in front of the building. And then when we did it, most people that arrived still couldn't really understand what was going on. Partly it was because we were dressed in smart clothes, but I think mainly it's because we were lots of young women who had done something that they really couldn't conceive of. They couldn't believe that we were actually super glued to the windows. So that was a good example of how women can use the fact the sort of prejudices against them in society strategically to their own benefit, and that's a strength that we have in terms of doing direct action.
You're saying there that you were involved in, well, predominantly eight women, one man action. And I was wondering, was there any differences in how you felt that was organised and how it came together, as opposed to an action that you've been involved in that was either predominantly male or mixed, and how was it different, or did it?
Yeah, I think the point isn't whether everybody in the group is a woman. The point is what roles the women are taking. And in that particular action, the women did take the kind of significant sort of action roles, like the, you know, the recceing work and the action coordinator roles and the getting the equipment sort of roles. And so in that sense, it was different to other actions that I've been on. I think there's a lot of actions where, you know, the equipment side of things, the strategy side of things.
Men like holding tools, don't they?
It's exactly.
Fucking ridiculous, but yeah.
But that kind of brings up a point that we talked about in the workshop today about skill sharing. And oftentimes I think women are intimidated by being in situations because they lack certain skills or think that they don't have the knowledge or the wherewithal to do various actions, when in reality part of the structure is to be able to sort of skill share and learn new skills and stuff like that. And but in regards to the representation of women in the media, do you find it sort of difficult to resolve the fact that you're playing along with a very sexist attitude that can be, you know, misconstrued from various actions?
I think that's a really difficult one to respond to, because of course it is incredibly difficult, but we also both use it to our advantage and acknowledge that difficulty. So I'm not sure I really have a solution to offer on that one. I think it's a,
I mean, I think the world is sexist and it's going to remain sexist for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. I think there's certainly limits to how much we would play up to the sexist nature of particularly the sort of corporate media. For example, we all know full well that if we turned up to any action in bikinis, we would get a hell of a lot more attention. But we're not going to do that, because that would be it would contravene all of our morals, I think, or our kind of education in terms of how women get respect. So, yeah, I think there are limits, but it's, in a way, it's the fact that women doing direct action is still surprising and is still new. It keeps people interested in what we're doing. And so if you want to deal with an issue like climate change, and which is already becoming something which is kind of, after it's already becoming a story that's been done, to make it fresh, you can use different angles, and certainly women taking stronger roles in direct action and roles that society doesn't expect them to take is one way to keep those kind of issues on the front page.
Well, on that note, I just wanted to thank you for coming in and talking to us about women's place in direct action.
Thank you.
Any sort of actions or affinity groups planned for the camp, perhaps? Women only? Any news on that?
Well, not for us. I mean, the group that we met with today, that did the workshop, there were a lot of people in that group that said that they would really like to organise an all-female affinity group. And hopefully, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a role for that in the climate change movement, so hopefully something will come of that. But we're a bit busy at the moment. We're playing stupid.
Yeah, I can imagine. Thanks so much. And now we're going to go into a track.
Neil wants to say something about that background noise.
I just wanted to apologize for the helicopter.
It's Neil's fault.
It is my fault. I did arrive by helicopter and it's waiting for me now, and it has to wait in the sky. So, you know,
it's way too high.
Sorry about the helicopter. It's the cops. They're really fucking annoying.
Anyway. We're going to have our food review for today with Miss Many Miles.
Hello?
And Peter Pan.
Not the real Peter Pan.
And so, what are we having for dinner tonight?
Well, tonight, Bicycology Food Reviewers went down to the teapot, Annika's teapot.
Mm.
Ooh. Got a reputation to hold up.
They have got a very big reputation to hold up. And they're...
And they've written several cookery books.
They've written a very good cookery book lately.
Mm. Yeah.
Another Dinner is Possible. And tonight they've come up with a very unconventional dinner. I'll give them that.
Two types of carbohydrate on one plate, but it doesn't seem to work.
Pasta sandwiches.
So what we've got here is butternut squash stew.
And garlicky seedy pasta.
Wait, basil-y. Basil-y garlicky seedy pasta.
Garlicky basil-y seedy pasta.
Yeah, some couscous and a very nice salad with apple-y bits in and so on. So we think it's pretty good. I think it's pretty good. It's really maybe good. We've had a bit of too much couscous, but the teapot are saying that they're having a bit of a struggle at the moment because they went along to the kitchen with all these grand ideas and were beset by a bit of a lack of ingredients.
Oh.
So anyway, for fun, we're now going to pass over to you guys to say what you think. So
okay, here
should
we
start with the start with the stew, maybe?
Which bit's the stew? Seriously,
the sauce, man. The sauce,
the saucy bit. Okay. Oh, here we go. Hang on.
So.
This has got lots of coconut in it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I like that. Yeah.
More of that.
Okay, let's see what our other reviewer thinks.
Okay. It's
very coconutty, very creamy, quite, you know, nice texture, nice and soft.
Yeah.
I like it, yes.
Good texture on the butternut.
Good texture on the butternut.
That couscous is fine. No starch.
That's pretty fluffy. Pretty fluffy.
So, okay, should we move on to the pasta then?
Yeah. Shall I feed you, Neil?
Pasta, yeah. Lovely stuff. Oh, you're feeding me. This is a bit saucy. Okay.
Oh, he's eating the pasta. Personally, I like this pasta because it has just the right amount of garlic in.
What's in it?
Basil. Basil's, I think, the main flavour.
Yeah.
Basil pasta.
It's interesting. Unconventional.
Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, it's an interesting combination with the stew, but they're both nice.
They are both nice, yeah.
And then
so
there's
the salad.
Tasty,
a bit of salad.
Yeah. Bit of veg for the old...
The salad is a beautiful colour. We've got the pinks from the beetroot.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a rather interesting variegated cucumber, and then there's the fresh spring green of a Granny Smith apple.
Yeah.
I definitely love a little bit of apple in my salad.
Yeah, I think that's a good move.
Really nice touch.
So we only have one complaint about the salad, which was pointed out by some of the teapot chefs. So I think, you know, we're not going to mark them down on this one. But one of the servers put the salad on top of the hot food.
What a bastard.
Or bitch.
That's a faux pas in the kitchen. We're watching you, servers. That's the food we're recommending.
Yeah. Plates and cutlery clean.
Very clean.
Very clean.
Okay, that's good to know. Did someone wash your hands before you got the food?
What, for us?
Yeah.
You're kidding. No. Why? Did that happen to you?
I was getting breakfast this morning and there was this lady with a bucket and some soap washing everyone's hands for them.
Yeah, it was a very interesting experience.
Yeah, it was. The Mother Teresa of the kitchen world. Yeah. And it was weird. So now,
she's extremely apologetic as well. Anyway, so thank you so much for coming in and
actually,
sharing.
Do we get a score?
Yeah, yes, we should get a score. I think five, right? I think it's definitely up on last night.
What was last night?
Last night I said 4, so because it was pretty good.
See, this is the problem with scoring out of 5.
It's not.
There's not much room for. We should do 10.
We score out of 10.
And will we give 10 out of 10? So.
So yesterday was an 8. And today is going to be a 9. Otherwise, we can call today a 4.5. But I mean,
yeah,
scoring out of 10 makes more sense.
Yeah, more flexibility.
But we should say that lunch, we weren't too impressed by lunch today either of us.
No, I had some very, very stodgy couscous.
Me too, yeah. That's what I had. And it was all that was left. We won't name names.
Don't know who they were.
Since we turned up too late to get a decent amount of lunch, so that's our own fault, that's our own call.
I don't know. Anyway, okay.
I just got to do one little thing about teapot. We haven't marked them down, but they did get me arrested today. Their tables did. Luckily, it all worked out fine in the end.
They got you arrested?
Wow. I've never been arrested because of a table before. So that's one for the CV. One last other thing that we forgot to talk about as we're Bicycology. We're doing a film night right now, Bicycology Bike Film Night in the cinema there, Pedal and Soda Powered Film Night, short films. Okay. And tomorrow morning we're doing 11:30 to 1 a pedal generation workshop, and 2 o'clock.
What 11:30 to 1?
11:30 to 1. Okay. A workshop on building your own pedal generator and what you can use it for and what you can't use it for. And so. And
okay. Then that'd be interesting.
2 o'clock we're going to ride out of the camp and go on a little bike ride with anyone who wants to join us on the bike library bikes, which we've got over by our space.
The purpose of which is to meet the local villagers and to encourage them to come up to the camp.
Cool.
Yeah, do outreach, but also some people are just going for a pleasurable ride, just to chill out and get away from the hectic.
Will it be chilled out, or will you have a load of cops around
you?
I'd say the latter. But okay, well, thanks very much for coming in again.
Yeah, thank you.
Are we ready for the relevant track?
Have we got a relevant track queued, Mr. Miss Master? Party boy? Let's have it.
We got a food track, yeah.
Thanks again.
It's all love, it's all love, it's all sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school, my household smell like soul food, bruh. Curry falafel, barbecue tofu, no fish, no candy bars, no cigarettes, only ganja, fresh squeezed juice from oranges. Exercising daily to stay healthy, and I rarely drink water out the tap cause it's filthy.
Lentil soup is mento fruit, and ginger root is good for the youth. Fresh vegetable with them ice high stew. Sweet yam fries with the green hallelujah. Careful how you season and prepare your foods, cause you don't wanna lose vitamins and minerals, and that's the jewel. Life brings life, it's valuable, so I eat what comes from the ground, it's natural. Let your food be your medicine, no excedrin. Strictly herb generates from the sun, cause I got melanin and drink water. 8 glasses a day, cause that's what they say.
They say you are what you eat, so I strive to eat healthy. My goal in life is not to be rich or wealthy, but true wealth comes from good health and wise ways. We gotta start taking better care of ourselves. They say you are what you eat, so I
I strive to eat healthy. My goal in life is not to be rich or wealthy, cause true wealth comes from good health and wise ways. We gotta start taking better care of ourselves. Be healthy, y'all.
All right, hello. We're with Ruth from the Global Women Strike. She's been to a few of the workshops today, and she'd like to give us some feedback from a women's perspective from the camp.
Okay. I wanted to start, actually, not with one of the workshops, but with the standoff with the police. Yesterday morning, I was really glad to hear the two sisters talking about what women can contribute, particularly to direct action. And I think one of the high points of the camp so far for me was the woman who confronted the police with this question, how many of you have children? Now, it could have been a man who said that, but it's not an accident that it was a woman, because women are the ones who, even more than men, care for our children, care about our children, invest so much of ourselves and our hopes in our children. And men, women, for that reason, I think, have always felt most strongly about climate change and have always organized on environmental issues, not only climate change, but pollution and all the other things that are actually endangering our health and our families and undoing the hard work that we do trying to keep people healthy and keep them alive. So, you know, that was, I think, a really critical question, and I did see a change in the police. And I heard that one of the police officers, I don't know if it was a man, there was one woman there, had to be taken off crying, not after that particularly, but I think we did get through to them with what they are protecting and what they're stopping us from trying to do something about. So that is a big contribution. It was not an accident that a woman made that question. On the workshops, the first one I wanted to comment on, really, was a workshop called Is It Too Late? And towards the end of that workshop, one of the people, the person leading it actually, said that the big thing that we had to count on now, that we had to hope for, was Copenhagen. And I don't think we can count on the people who are going to Copenhagen. Probably he wouldn't either. Don't want to sort of fix him in that box. But I think most of us in the workshop agreed that actually what happens outside and what we do is the critical thing. And for that, what we have to count is not just people like those of us who are here at the climate camp, and not only also all the other people who, for one reason or another, perhaps family responsibilities, perhaps jobs, having to earn a living, whatever, couldn't actually come to the camp. But we have to count the massive movement that exists around the world against the kind of destruction that we're seeing of the environment and of the planet. And that if we see how big that movement is, there's actually a lot more hope, because it's not just a movement in rich countries. It's not just a movement of white people. The Global Women's Strike that I work with, part of what we do is to make visible and help connect and strengthen with each other's support the movements that are not seen, which are often people who are poorest, living in the poorest countries, are often women who are generally invisible, you know, in the media. Not, you know, first of all, our suffering doesn't get seen as much. I mean, you may have heard the statistics that women are 70% of the world's poor, and therefore the most vulnerable to, you know, any loss, when you have hardly anything to eat and that's taken away, you're in a much different position than when you have a lot to eat and a little bit's taken away. But also 85% of people who die from climate-induced disasters. So, you know, that is how women are affected. That's some of the ways that women are affected. But what's not seen even more is the way that women are actually fighting against it. We're seen sometimes as victims, but the incredible resistance that women have organized, sometimes just organizing survival, you know, that is a form of resistance in itself, especially when they're trying to kill us all like they are now. And it is women who do the survival work in most communities. Women are not on the front line, not mostly on the front line of killing wars, but we are on the front line of the war for survival, and we are maintaining our communities and keeping our children alive in the most impossible situations. And I think if you look at Palestine, for instance, or if you look at Iraq, we have a lot to learn from what women are doing there. You know, dealing with hunger, dealing with the trauma, traumatized children, and keeping fighting at the same time. In that same workshop, one of the things that came up was James Lovelock's quote, you know, saying actually we had to give up on, because we couldn't save the world, it was too late, and we should just enjoy our lives. He has a lot of nerve, you know, when you consider what lives people have to enjoy and what fight they're still making to stay alive and keep their families, communities alive, you know, through that. And he's about to say, okay, give up, it's all right, you know, because maybe he has a comfortable life to enjoy. So I think one of the things that we have to look at is who's fighting and also who's paying. Because one of the fights that people are making is over who is going to pay the price for climate change. I'm also in Women Against Rape, and we're always fighting for compensation. And one reason we fight for compensation is because we say, so long as they don't pay us anything, so long as the state doesn't suffer anything, they'll just allow us to keep on being raped again and again. If they have to look at a cost to themselves, they're much more likely to take it seriously. And with that in mind, we have to look at the struggles that people are making, not to be the ones who have to pay the price for climate change. And I'm going to give some examples of those. The first one is seeking asylum. That's often seen as an issue that is not related to this. But the fact is that many of the asylum seekers in this country now are in fact climate change refugees, because they're refugees from wars. And they're refugees, they're seeking asylum from persecution, resisting war or resisting the economic devastation that has been imposed on their countries. A lot of that economic devastation and a lot of those wars increasingly are actually a result of drought, floods, lack of resources, which more and more come down to climate change. And what the people who come here seeking asylum are doing is they're refusing to pay the price. They're saying, I'm not going to die. I'm not going to allow my children, if possible, to die. I'm not going to be wiped out by this change that you're imposing, and I will come to the countries that are imposing that on us. And as a result, some of the people who are imposing climate change are having to do their sums again, because they can't say, okay, we will just wipe out those large parts of the world and we will suffer nothing for it. They have to know that the people in those parts of the world will not put up with it and will come to their own countries and demand the money that they need to survive. So that question of not paying the price for other people's pollution and other people's destruction of the climate is actually critical. Another example is from the 20 years ago. This is in this country, when at that time the Wages for Housework campaign, Black Women for Wages for Housework, and WinVisible, which is an organization still going of women with visible and invisible disabilities, were opposing the building of Hinkley C nuclear power station and saying you have to count the work of the women who are going to clean up, the work of the women who are going to care for the people who become ill as a result of Hinkley C. You know, not only leukemia, which increases, of course, with any nuclear power station, but also asthma, loss of immunity, allergies, and other things on a daily basis. You know, they didn't even want to count the cost of disposing of the waste. But we said you have to count not only that, you have to count the effect on the population. And one way of doing that is look at the work that women have to do. Nobody counts it because it's not paid.
We're just expected to pay that extra price in grief and suffering with our sick children, you know, and that extra work of staying up nights, and nobody's going to count that. And we said, look at the United Nations resolutions that say you have to measure and value the unwaged work of caring for people. Look at those resolutions and put that into your calculation about whether you want a nuclear power station or not. The resolutions say that women actually do 2/3 of the world's work for 5% of the income and 1% of the assets. You know, so we're not talking about a marginal activity here. But it is an activity that is discounted. You know, we're called economically inactive if we're only caring for people, as if that were not the most important work in the world. I want to give some other examples, but I don't want to talk too long. Maybe you want a music track or something?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to put a track on? Okay. I wanted to give some examples of some of these unseen struggles or struggles that aren't counted as part of the movement against climate change. In Guyana, the people have faced the most incredible, horrendous floods that have wiped out their homes, and in fact flooded whole areas up to chest height. And some of the demands of women in that situation have been, first of all, to have access to food aid, because when the food aid's delivered, it's often too far for many of them to walk through the floods to get to. The people who are most flooded are most deprived of the food. And they've actually demanded that the food be made accessible to them. And also that they won't do the job of cleaning up the toxic water and the results, the leavings of the toxic water, without protective suits, without pay, as they've been expected to do. And they've demanded compensation and a full accounting of the money that is spent. Because, of course, when you have a disaster, some money does flood into an area, but whose pockets does it go into? And we know that one aspect of disaster capitalism is corporations make a killing on the money for the work that, in fact, the women are doing without even the protection that official people would have. They sent a letter with these demands to trade unions, government agencies, NGOs, women's groups. They got it published in the big daily papers. And this was multiracial grassroots women's organizing, which in a very racially divided country really made history. And they did win some compensation. It didn't cover their losses, but, it was some compensation. And they won things, for instance, vets for sick animals, you know, which when you're farming and dependent on that is also critical. So they, again, tackled the question of who's to pay, you know, that they can't just warm the climate, flood everybody out, and then get away scot-free while the people suffer for it. And their refusal of the poverty resulting from climate change is also part of the refusal of climate change. In the United States, similarly, with Hurricane Katrina, the government wanted to wash their hands of the people. And the people there, again, because of the increased weather disasters like hurricanes, suffered with this. They tried to get their homes rebuilt. They'd been kicked out of their homes. They were put in hotels separate from all their family, you know, not even knowing where their families were, put in their hotels for months, and then the money stopped and they were basically kicked out. So that these were people who were regarded as dispensable. You know, Madeleine Albright once said the U.S. is the indispensable nation, but she wasn't obviously referring to the people of New Orleans when she said that they were indispensable. Then there's Uganda, where it was not flood and not hurricane, but drought. And it still is drought. It's a complete, more and more a desertification. People walking for water many, many miles, having to carry the water back from scraping it out of a riverbed, facing rape on the way, there and back. And the women in Kabong, where we're in touch with Kabong Women's Group, built their own women's center, started an orchard on the system where each woman would water one tree. Now, watering one tree doesn't sound like a big job, but when you reckon where you have to get the water from, it's not a small thing at all. But they have maintained that orchard. And that fight for survival is also a big fight. They've also had to fight for food aid, because the World Food Program was into giving food to the people who were, quote, working. And, of course, if you're caring for children or breastfeeding, that is not counted as work. And they fought and won that. So that's three examples of that kind of refusal to be the ones who pay for global warming and climate change. There's other examples of struggles that haven't been seen as part of it. One of them is in Nigeria. I went to a workshop today where somebody was speaking about the oil delta in Nigeria, where Ken Sarawiwa was fighting and was murdered for his fight. And the I hadn't understood before this workshop, really, how complete the pollution of the land. Apparently, one Exxon Valdez oil tanker a year for the past 50 years has spilled out. There are all sorts of leaks which are burning, nobody does anything about them. And the system is that when gas is produced as a result of the oil being produced, the gas is burned off as flares, which have been flaring for 50 years, producing more emissions than the whole of the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. So when you're looking at what could be cut down, you know, that is one of them. And that's just because Shell wants to save the money. They don't want to use the gas, and they don't want to do anything else with it. They just burn it. There's been a massive armed struggle against that in that area, against the theft of the resources and the pollution of the land, and also an unarmed struggle led by women, nonviolent resistance, including one case where women actually shut down an oil installation temporarily. Part of what they did, just listening to the sisters here talking about not going to, you know, not wanting to appear in bikinis to get publicity, part of what these women were threatening was to take off all their clothes, which apparently is traditional there, and people don't have quite the same scruples. But, you know, use it as a weapon to save their land and their livelihood. Similarly, China, which is normally seen as the place where is the big problem, right? You know, so many new coal-fired power stations. But what people don't hear about is the massive resistance inside China of people who are fighting to save their land. And it's peasants, it's poor people in villages who have practically nothing, you know, very, very little. And they're organizing riots, basically, involving thousands or sometimes tens of thousands of people. Again, women are often central to this. There was one riot where there were 200 elderly women, keeping a vigil outside a chemical factory, which they wanted to expand. And they were blaming the chemical factory for ruined crops and their children being born with deformities. And their banner above their little bamboo hut said, "Give me back my land, save my children and grandchildren." And that hut and the women were mowed down, and two women died. And after that, the whole village rioted. And they had to send in 3,000, like, riot police. But, people were using their pitchforks and their farm implements. That kind of thing is going on a regular basis, but we don't get that in the news about China. There was another one over the building of a coal-fired power station. You know, so it's just that, again, the unseen resistance that means our movement is much stronger than it otherwise would appear to be. I just wanted to move on before finishing to talk about the possibilities that aren't seen. Because a workshop that I went to today about population control, which was organized by No Borders, you know, very, very interesting material. But somebody said that the problem was not population, the problem was overconsumption. And I think we're giving them too much if we assume that the world's people, even those of us who live on reasonable incomes in Western countries, are actually overconsuming. We have to look at the carbon cost of what the military are doing. The military is not a marginal part of the economy. It is a massive part of the economy. Even the military aircraft and flying soldiers all over the world is a very big contribution. We have to look at waste. We have to look at the fact that in the US, half of food is wasted. Not only wasting the fuel and everything that goes into growing that food, packaging it, producing the packaging, distributing it around the country, and then dealing with it after that, you know, shopping and the rest of it. Not only that, but then the wasted food goes into landfill and produces methane. You know, in this country, the figure's a bit lower, maybe around a third, rather than a half, but also very high. we have to look at things like breastfeeding, where there's a very healthy, good food for children naturally available, which has been supplanted in many, many places by baby milk formula, which poisons them, but is preferred because it produces profit, and is pushed in hospitals because it produces profit. And, you know, it's just another example of the fact that anything that has a monetary tag on it that somebody can make a profit over out of is prioritized over what is actually natural and for the benefit of people. So that what we're living with is actually an upside-down economy where what's counted as growth is just capital's growth, not children's growth. Where what's counted as work is only the work that goes to make profit. And where if we look at it with fresh eyes, if we actually look at the amount of production and the amount of consumption that is actually, for us, it's actually a tiny proportion of what's going on. And I think that means that we have different possibilities than people have been seeing, because in that workshop there were some people who were saying, oh, you just have to live, you have to look at the numbers. You have to live with these numbers. You know, the population is so high. You know, the carbon production is so high. Well, we have to look at the product, at the numbers, but we have to look at them with a different eye to see that what has been seen as possible is very limited, just as what's been seen as the movement is very limited in comparison with the changes that we really could make. And I think if we start as women with the what doesn't have a monetary value, like our work, like the planet, you know, like crops, like breast milk, if we start with those things, we'll have a different way in that will actually strengthen the climate movement enormously. And I think that the kind of lead that was given by the woman at the gate yesterday morning, you know, asking the police, how many of you have children? I think we have a lot further to go with that.
Okay, thank you. What's up next?
I'm going to come on now, and Louise from Feminist Fight Back is going to be talking with me. And we are basically, I think we failed to mention that we're trying to do a feminist and feminism and women in direct action based show today. Failed to mention that at the beginning. Sorry, there's always lots of hustle and bustle. But hi, Louise. Thanks for coming in and speaking with us today.
No worries.
Okay, so first of all, what is Feminist Fight Back? What do you guys do? What do you get involved in?
We're broadly a network of socialist feminists. Kind of very generally, we get involved in lots of kind of working women's struggles and generally women struggles from the poor end of society and our own struggles in the workplace. Mm-hmm. Over the last 2 years have organised two feminist fight back conferences. Yes. Where we've invited women from all over the world to kind of debate different forms of feminism and to discuss their struggles from wherever they are, within the labour movement, outside of it, I suppose very broadly we're trying to kind of move feminism away from just being a kind of an educated middle class thing, and trying to engage the wider cross-section of women within the movement as well.
And what would the purpose of that be? What sort of positive aspect of can feminism bring to a working class struggle? Do you have any sort of examples that you can give us?
Most recently, we were involved in the tube workers' strikes in London, which involved mainly women workers, women cleaners on the tube, from who are often immigrant women without papers, obviously incredibly vulnerable. And we supported their struggles, and from the kind of privileged position that we were in, as trade unionists and as women from like higher education, we were able to engage in quite a lot of direct action, which obviously they as kind of illegal immigrants often couldn't do, both because they'd be deported, and even if they were legal, probably lose their jobs. So
what sort of actions did you take?
We did three main actions. The first was to go to London Underground HQ and to clean it, essentially. We kind of just went and caused chaos with like brooms and mops and dusters and stuff, and read out the demands of these cleaning women. We did that. Should I tell you what some of those demands were? Just because I think it's quite important for some of one of the later actions, actually. So it wasn't just about demanding the London living wage, which is £7.45 an hour. It was also to widen those demands, to think about the conditions and the kind of dignity of these women. I have to kind of emphasise how much what we did in support and in solidarity was completely characterised by what these women wanted us to do. So we weren't just kind of like rolling up and being like, oh, don't worry, guys, we've got it in hand. We're going to go and fucking go to the HQ of London Underground and we'll tell them what for and we'll have a duster. We obviously, you know, there's a massive amount of engagement first. We went, you know. So we talked about holiday and sick pay that these women weren't guaranteed, free travel, dignity at work. You know, they had to get to work incredibly early just to ensure that they'd get any work, or otherwise they'd be sent home. Which, as you can imagine, like is for women that are in the kind of precarious position they're in anyway as illegal immigrants. You know, it's just to know it's whether you can like take home a pay packet or not. I guess like privileged position as men to both intimidate these women and it's kind of capitalising, as you say, on their illegal status. So part of what we're doing in our direct action was to put pressure on Transport for London to bring the employment of these workers back in-house, because as you probably know, Transport for London is privatised. It means that Transport for London doesn't have to take responsibility for what these women have to suffer. So we're calling as part of these demands to stop the kind of outsourcing of all of this work. So the second direct action thing we did was to dump huge bin bags of rubbish outside the HQ again, which is at St James's Park Tube, which is where which is the station where the strike was taking place as well. And we unfurled a banner saying, Transport for London, clean up your act. The third thing that we did was to go on Mayor's Question Time, the day that Boris Johnson announced that he was going to grant the London living wage to these cleaners. So this probably sounds a bit ridiculous that we kind of did a direct action against this announcement, but... it's basically to kind of emphasise the point that, you know, this Tory leader can't really come in and then just say, oh, you know, fuck your worker struggle, I'll give you, you know, your living wage and, you know...
Just like, go home
and shut up. Yeah, so it was... The point was to emphasise how many demands there were, the fact that working class struggle does not go away.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you can't have, like, some... Tory leader give a bit of concession and then expect all these women to be like, I'm sorry, you know, I'll carry on being sexually harassed, it's fine, don't worry about it. So there was a feminist right back rally outside of Mayor's Question Time and with RMT workers and a lot of the cleaners there, and and two Feminist Fight Back members went in and did a banner drop during the question time, which listed all of the demands.
Oh.
So,
in case you didn't know them beforehand.
Yeah, in case, yeah, yeah.
There's a banner in front. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good job.
Face to face. So, and that received a big round of applause, apart from all of the Tories in the room. So,
this is a direct action oriented camp, of course, but it is sort of oriented towards climate change action. Sure. But obviously there's a link between feminism and social justice and climate justice as well. Perhaps you'd like to expand upon that.
Well, I think over the course of just some of the last speaker, for instance, and the course of a lot of the workshops, we've been seeing the links between, you know, capitalism and climate change, obviously, and the kind of chaos that it's causing. And I think that just to be able to say that, you know, capitalism puts, you know, women in and workers in the kinds of position where they are exploited for mm-hmm. surplus value and for profit. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a kind of the most obvious way to kind of call the kind of the way that capitalism exhausts mm-hmm. people, but it's obviously exhausting the soil at the same time, and it exhausts kind of every kind of possible resource we have on the planet.
And one isn't really separate from the other. It's all a linked up system.
Exactly.
Of exploitation.
Yeah. And often, I mean, the reason that, you know, we talk about kind of the movement of people and immigration mm-hmm. And you can't really talk about that anymore without looking at the way our geography is changing and the way people are going to have to kind of flee different homelands because of climate change. So there's that.
And with Feminist Fight Back, are you guys going to be organizing another conference this year? And do you have any call outs for help with regarding
that? We'd always help if you're interested in getting involved. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to meet, kind of bring together struggles of race and class and women's struggles and class struggles. So, you know, anyone that's kind of interested in really putting the boot in the capitalism that way is absolutely fucking welcome. We're not sure as to what's going on this year. I'm afraid we've been trying to combine sort of our efforts with a few other groups, mm-hmm. And it's looking shakier than it has in previous years. But hopefully, I can just say go to the website and hopefully,
it's feministfightback.org.uk.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, look us up and give us a call.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming in to talk
to
us.
No problem. All right. Thank you very much.
Good luck with everything.
Cheers. Okay.
And I just wanted to give a quick plug to the Global Women's Strike website, which is globalwomenstrike.net.
And read that very slowly.
Yes, I just wanted to make sure that everybody out there was typing along with what I was saying. And next is Latin America Day stuff, and it's coming up tomorrow, and we're with
Matt. Hi.
Hi, Matt.
Yeah, I just thought I'd let everyone know that tomorrow here at the Climate Camp is Latin America Day. There's a whole series of events going on, including workshops, we've got films, we've got fiesta at the evening. So
fiesta.
Just to let you know what's going on about that, really.
Okay, cool. So what fun have you got in store for us?
Well, early on in the day, firstly at 12 o'clock, there's a workshop in the cinema space on Mexico and Oaxaca, and there's Apicitas. Now that's going on Space L from 12 till 1 o'clock. After that, 1:30 till 4 o'clock, there's a workshop including speakers from activists from all the different solidarity campaigns based in the UK with Hands Off Venezuela, the Colombia Solidarity Campaign, the Bolivia Solidarity Campaign, and also the Movement for Ecuadorians in the UK. Mm-hmm. So they'll be talking about a lot of the issues in Latin America and how they're facing the current global issues mm-hmm. on over there as well.
Okay, good.
We've also got films, including John Pilger. At 6 till 8 in the evening, we've got a Bolivian band who's coming to do a workshop.
Oh, fun.
They've got their costumes, which have come all the way over from Peru, which we're going to have to get in here somehow, but they'll happen, and they're going to be performing in the student cafe.
Oh, awesome.
Okay, cool. What time is that at?
That's at 6 o'clock till 8 o'clock in the evening.
We should record some and play some on the show for everybody.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
Okay, people are looking forward to that one already. Yeah. And then we carry on with a proper fiesta, 9:30 till late in the big space.
Yeah.
We've got Radio Revolution, we've got Movie Mentos DJs, and Poyote from Poyote for President all going to be playing, and keeping the Latin vibes going across the camp till late.
Okay, sweet, that looks like tomorrow night.
Should be good then.
Yeah, it should be. There's also other things happening on Thursday, but on tomorrow's show it would be good if we can bring you some of the activists as well that will be coming to speak, and they can maybe fill in a bit of what they've actually been seeing
in terms of the
global devastation to the environment in Latin America at the moment.
Yeah, definitely drop by and we'll organize that. Fantastic. And have them on tomorrow.
Don't leave too soon.
Yeah, don't leave yet. We need to talk to you up. So next we're going to have a track, and then we're going to go into the media review, which is a little bit of digest. Actually,
nah, that's not gonna happen.
Well, people tell me and changes. There's changes to the plan.
I know there's a lot of changes to the plan. I think since you've said we're putting on a track, Patrick's like rushing to put a track on now. So
we'll put a track on,
then we can set up the. Then we have some musicians. I believe we have a ukulele, a flute, and a guitar. Two ukuleles in the same tent. It's Climate Camp Ukulele Orchestra are going to be performing us. Doesn't make sense. Entertaining us later.
Exclusive.
So we're going to listen to a track and set up the sound. Okay, here we go.
Everybody would seem to like to belong to a tribe, whether it be music, religion, whatever. We're an old school punk band. What's your label? Well, all my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. But I ain't so late, you want to say goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome back to The Thing. This is Climate Camp Radio, apparently. All the mics are on, so we're joined by the Climate Camp Ukulele Orchestra, which is... Orchestra is a bit... But yeah, okay. Two instruments. Okay. Okay.
I see a flute.
Near complete. Yeah.
Yeah, we only met yesterday, so if there's any more ukuleles in the camp, just... come and find us.
Okay, we're gonna
a ukulele call out here.
Yeah, ukulele block on Saturday. Yeah. Okay, so we're gonna start.
We've just decided to do a tour of all the barrios too. So it's the Great Climate Camp Ukulele Orchestra Tour.
Wow.
This is
neighborhood
needed. Okay, cool. So we'll get rolling with a track then. Yeah.
All right. Do you want the pirate song first?
Pirate song. Okay. Here we go.
The song is for the blue team. Team blue.
Blue team. The lads going in. Oh,
shh. Sorry.
Okay. When I'm in sea, they call to me. The waves that crash so carelessly. Salt spray, sun blinds me still. The faces I just see. Late in the wind, it howls. The master shakes, the captain growls. That's when they call to me. Thrown about in the briny sea. Well, la la la.
Okay, cool. Thanks very much. Awesome. That was the pirate song, apparently. What's the next song?
What do you want to do next? Do you want to do the Calypso one?
Calypso song is next. There we go. Okay. Are you a lefty ukulele player?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Plays upside down. Okay, that's pretty good. Okay. Getting the mouth organ together. Yeah. So, filling time, I'm filling time.
For a blues song.
Oh, well.
Fuck no.
Yeah. I think we have
who's
a nod from Mark. He's going to come up, step up to the mic.
So, yeah, you're not barred yet, Mark. So.
Are there any subtitles or suggestions of any what it might be concerning?
Impromptu blues session here. Okay.
Blues.
The blues. He takes off his blue bag.
Great. So we have a guest vocalist. What's your name?
Carpentown Crier.
Awesome. My name's KT.
And I'm delighted to be on stage with you gorgeous, amazing players. With a homemade harmonica holder as well. It's beautiful.
Wow, that's quite innovative.
Thanks.
All right.
Today, for to fetch some sound equipment for the stage, I had to leave this beautiful place, that's true. I had to encounter the forces of the Babylonian forces, and they deployed their most subversive and brain confusing weapon, which was their friendly approach and their bonhomie and their joking. Ha 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 ha, they said when I sang a little song about how I wasn't gonna let them take my soul from me. They went ha ha ha, isn't that nice? Sonny boy, play that thing. He was with me too. He was sitting on the back of the bicycle, that's why the damn chain came off. I was halfway up the hill, having been searched and searched and searched and searched again. I didn't have a little piece of pink paper to show them, so they searched me again and again, just for luck. This time they said, we don't believe in luck, but we'll still search you for luck. And anyway, I'm coming to the very crux of the story now.
I was halfway up the hill and the damn chain came off with the three damn huge boxes full of technical equipment. Oh, and the policeman at the top of the gate said, "Would you like me to help you here, sir?" And I said, "No. Thank you, no." And he looked so crestfallen, a man from the police department. I said, "You know, your friendliness and your abusive, violent approach yesterday and your friendliness today is designed to destroy my head, my heart and my soul, so I prefer to just to maintain the kind of distance from you, thank you very much." And it looked like he felt so sad and abused and let down, like I'd spat in his face. But it was just a sheer act of self-preservation on my part. I said, nope. And then I came to the gate and a nice person from the climate camp came and said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yeah, okay." So she helped push me up to the gate and he looked so crestfallen and I don't care anymore. He's a beautiful human being, he looks so crestfallen, but too bad. And I made it way and I said, "They're deploying their most deepest, most subversive Babylonian friendliness today. Put your Babylonian friendliness away. I can't cope with that today." Oh, and that's what he did. At least I think that's what he did. And I think it's what he did. It's what he did. And then they sent the helicopter round to drop their metaphorical leaflets of friendly and balmy on us. The man in the helicopter is saying, "I love you all in the climate camp. If only I could turn my engine off, you'd hear me singing love songs to you all down there below. But if I did that, I would have to join you in a very intimate fashion. I don't want to take out your turbines with my rotors, so I'll leave my motors up here in the sky. And you'll never know why and how much I do love you so. Time for a solo."
And as if the music, that wasn't enough, we're going to have some more music on. And we're here with Mike, and he's here with his guitar. And we like Mike a lot because he does so much for us in regards like wires and stuff that I don't really understand. But it just works. And then we're broadcasting, and it's great. But I'm basically filling space because he's taking off his jacket right now and coming up to the stage.
Cool.
Yeah. So, what kind of tunes are you going to play for us tonight?
I'm going to play two songs that are my songs. One of them's a more of a sort of hippie song, and the other one's more of a sort of protest song.
Cool. Sounds great.
Okay. Might just take 1 minute just to
A little tune up here.
So just while he's doing that, just like to big up ourselves and some other crews that are involved in the radio project. So Climate Camp Radio is brought to you by, in no particular order, it's brought to you by Flash Radio, Rise Up Radio out of Nottingham, Plenty Fact, who are providing the streaming, and of course Dissident Island. Which is us, yeah. Just to let you know that if you want to kind of continue listening to this sort of material after the camp, that those are the kind of outlets that you can go to. Check them out.
And in the future, we will be doing a more formal thanks to all our help, and we'll have more website and email information to contact us. But now back to Mike.
Hello. Right, so this first song we're going to play is quite an old song, and it's called Far and Wide. So it's quite an old song, really, this, but anyway. It's new to the radio, I suppose. Yeah.
rain in your eyes. Such a surprise. Place in the sun. I never want for nothing, but always yearn for something. Changing your looks is only a fatal facade. Traveling from far and wide, this planet in which we all walk, collected at this point right here, an infinite impossibility. Through inner city jungles, writing all your poetry up on the worn and concrete wall. Ever get the faint impression of being herded into the fold? Did you ever think that under this impression there'd be nothing left that you could be sold a hand? Don't you say to me, my life it ain't for free. I will choose my direction, I'll choose my confessions. There's nothing to hold us to this reality. Choose my direction, I'll choose my confessions. There's nothing to hold us to this reality. Such a surprise, place in the sun, where you never want for nothing, but always yearn for something. Changing your looks is only a fatal facade.
I've just got to do a quick sort of retuning of my guitar now.
Okay. Well, I'll fill time by giving you the web addresses for the crews who are running the thing. That's this. DissidentIsland.org, FlashRadio.wordpress.net. Shit. FlashRadio.wordpress.com. Is it net or com? FlashRadio.wordpress. Stop trying to confuse me, you fucking. FlashRadio.wordpress.com. And look up Rise Up Radio on the internet. I don't know. What? Oh, it's on the Dissident on the website, so follow the links there now, lads. Okay, and plenty fact. Hi. You ready to roll there, Mikey? Filling time.
Yeah, I know you're filling time very well, actually.
Thank you. I've done it before, you know.
Who would have guessed? I just want to say, actually, to make this happen, we've done loads of things, haven't we? Because we had to put the marquee up and stuff in the rain and everything, which we'd never done before, really. And we did a cable in digging workshop as well, didn't we?
Remember the tent blew upside down on top of our tent?
Yes, and also the tent flew over the top of this tent and everything. So we've had kind of fun and games along the way, haven't we? So.
I noticed no wires are in them trenches we dug.
No, they moved the tent, yes, I know. So there's going to be another trench digging workshop at some point soon.
Masterclass this time, isn't it?
Sorry. Okay, this is a song that's a couple of years old now, but it was about the Iraq invasion, I suppose you could call it. So, oh, God. Out there in the desert where that strange light falls upon the ancient lands that have blessed them all day long, you bear the heat and the sandstorm squalls blow sand into your eyes. You wish that you weren't so far from home, from the people that you know, from that girl next door that always loved you so. Mom is crying in the kitchen for the day that she'll see your sweet young face again. Papa's got the television blaring in his face. Rupert's cat that rates you daydream keeps him in his place. And he may suspect, but he shows no signs of thinking. It might happen real soon, and your sister's down the mall, she's getting fast food fat, while her boyfriend gets recruited by some army diplomat, and she subs on her coke and stares at the polystyrene carton that she holds in her hands. It's a symbol of the liberty that you're fighting for. Let's get them out of mosques and into department stores, give them credit cards whilst they are still bleeding. Send your sons and daughters to the firing line. Send them back in boxes, line upon line. And our heroes shall fall, where the rich will just get richer. Send your sons and daughters to the firing line. Send them back in boxes, line upon line. And our heroes shall fall, so the rich can just get richer. And there's nothing really more to it than what you shall win. That bent-backed woman with the severed limb. The man whose house is just rubble. The smells of cordite. But how the stars shine so bright and shining down upon you as you ride in. See the smiling faces of the permanent victims looking up at you, expecting some kind of gratitude, but they will never come true. And suddenly you realize it was all a lie. The mortar shell explodes and you just have time to curse that bastard and his falcons in the great big White House. With his freshly cut lawn, and back there in your small town, your mother stands with your father who still can't understand. Whilst his son is laid to rest, sheathed in that star-spangled banner. Now it's got a new star, and your sister's getting fatter, and the girl next door has found someone else that she was looking for. He's a broker in the city, selling all offshore, and our hero shall fall so the rich can just get rich. And now it's gunshot, gunpowder, cold steel joy. Feels so good in your hands, you're one of the big boys. Crosshairs, long-range missile brings liberty and freedom to all who feel that warm rip of flesh collapsing on the ground. Eyes staring up at you, boots planted in the sand, and surely they must thank their God to die in peace and freedom. So send your sons and daughters to the firing line. Send them back in boxes, line upon line. And our heroes shall fall so the rich can just get richer, yeah. So send your sons and daughters to the firing line. Send them back in boxes, line upon line. And our heroes shall fall so the rich can just get richer, oh yeah. Just get richer, yeah. just get richer, oh yeah. And our heroes shall fall so the rich can just get richer, can just get richer, yeah, can just get richer. And our heroes shall fall so the rich can just get richer.
That was beautiful, beautiful stuff. And actually, next up, we're going to have Danny, and he's going to be giving us a media review, sort of digest of stuff that's been happening in the press since we've been at Climate Camp and haven't had access to papers and stuff like that. So, take it away. Let us know what's going on.
Yes, hello. Right, I've tried to digest Dan a bit, but it's also a kind of little bit of the story of the media crew here at Climate Camp over the last few days. So, I mean, essentially, the mainstream media team here, it's our job to try to manage all the media coverage that the Climate Camp's getting, to talk to journalists, to send out press releases, and to then actually try and control all the journalists that turn up at the site every day and want to run around filming everything. Obviously we have quite a strict policy that was agreed before the camp at all the gatherings, that mainstream journalists are only allowed on site between the hours of 11 and 1, or at least they're only allowed to do filming and photography and recording in those hours. They are allowed on the site the rest of the time, but they aren't allowed to be doing any interviews or anything like that.
Okay. Is that the same as last year's policy, or is it slightly changed?
It's slightly changed from last year. It's essentially, it's allowing journalists to be on site outside those hours. Last year, they were only allowed on site between 11 and 1, and then they were kicked off. But the problem with that was that all of the journalists that wanted to stay on the camp, learn all about us, write quite detailed pieces, were kicked off. And so all the ones that were actually interested in the camp, we had to get rid of, whereas the ones who wanted to write horrible stories about us just came in undercover anyway and wrote horrible stories about us. So it wasn't actually, you know, doing as much good. But at the same time, we couldn't let the camp become a total media fishbowl with cameras everywhere and recording equipment everywhere, obviously.
No, wouldn't be cool. No.
So not really what we want. So, our job's a mixture of kind of trying to manage the media and do press releases, and also sort of babysitting journalists all day, which is not always enviable. But with wild optimism on Sunday night here at the camp, we wrote a little bulletin of, you know, the media coverage so far and how it's all been going, which we stuck up around in the neighbourhoods, saying, yes, we're going to do this every day. And then obviously since then things have
gone to shit, yeah.
Completely crazy for everybody.
Yeah,
so it hasn't
quite
happened. So I'm hoping
we were hoping to do something similar as well. We haven't actually managed to do it once.
Yeah.
So you're ahead of us, man, you know.
Well, yeah. But I'm hoping that maybe this little radio report will kind of count for it. But anyway, essentially you may have seen a little bulletin. If you haven't, then the run up to the camp coverage has been, you know, all right. We had a nice bit in the Guardian sort of saying, how to come to Climate Camp and have a great time, and sort of telling people what to bring and encouraging them to come, which is quite nice.
That was good.
We had a few interviews on Radio 4, bits and bobs. But what's been quite nice though is all the different big political figures that have been popping out of the woodwork and coming out against new coal power and new coal power at King's North. Mm-hmm. And just the very fact that we are holding this camp this week has kind of brought the issue to the fore and has brought out all these different statements from people. So we were already having an influence on the whole media debate.
Being forced to talk.
Exactly.
Say something about it.
Exactly, you know, and that meant that, you know, it's not a coincidence that the government's Environmental Audit Committee came out with a big statement saying new coal power would be a bad idea unless it was somehow magically you could make the CO2 disappear. I think it's called CCS. then also some energy consultants, some like big mainstream energy consultants called Poirier, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, came out with this big report saying that we don't need new coal, we don't need new nuclear in this country, that it's perfectly possible to power the country with energy efficiency and renewables at least till 2020. So that was on the Friday just before we started. So, you know, it's not a coincidence these things are coming out now. Dr. David King, who used to be chief scientific advisor to the government, came out with a statement against King's North and new coal. You know, it's all been happening, and it's us who have sparked kicked all this off. So even before we began, we were kind of setting the agenda. So yeah, that was all a fairly good start. And then Sunday, you know, things were moderately quiet on the camp. We had like the main TV crews around, you know, we had like BBC and various people like that. But most journalists were out covering the climate march and the climate caravan. So there was quite a lot of nice coverage of that, and it gave people a nice sort of colourful story for the first day. And so it was all sort of ticking along rather nicely, you know, and we were sort of doing our best to manage journalists and work out the rules and this sort of thing. And then on Monday, things obviously got interesting. And, you know, we woke up in the morning here, the media crew at the camp, knowing it was going to be quite a busy day, because we had the bail breakers arriving on site. Obviously the people who did the fantastic Drax Coltrane protest and had been given bail conditions that they could not come to the Hoo Peninsula and could not come to the climate camp, had publicly announced on Saturday that they were going to break their bail and come to the climate camp because it was so important. So we knew they were arriving in the afternoon and there was going to be lots of media interest in that. Mm-hmm. We knew that Arthur Scargill was doing a workshop on the camp.
Busy.
So there was clearly going to be some media interest in that. And also, some of the locals here, there's a fantastic local climate action group here who'd arranged to have they'd arranged for Norman Baker, who's a Liberal Democrat MP, to come to the camp and speak, who's, you know, he's quite sort of on message and full frontal about kind of climate change and sort of radical action needed and stuff. So we knew he was going to be here in those media. And also, confusingly, the Arthur Scargill thing and the MP thing were happening outside the normal media hours. So we were going to have to manage that and try to cram them into the media tent and do interviews in there and or do them outside the gate or, you know, various things like that. So we were already a little bit stressed out. And when all the journalists arrived, then we had to sort of shepherd them around. And there's the usual thing of photographers trying to go off and photograph people and members of the media team having to run after them and drag them back and you know, all that sort of usual palaver. And then the BBC had been wandering around with a camera and I'd been sort of trying to look after them. And then they were like, look, we just really want to hang around and wait for Arthur Scargill and just do a really quick interview with him. And I was like, well, look, you can't do it because it's going to be outside the media hours, but you could do it down at the gate. So, you know, you could film him coming in. So if your camera is pointing out of the camp and you can see him climbing over the gate, then okay. And then if you want to do a quick interview with him in the media tent, okay. So the BBC were there waiting and waiting and waiting. And it got to like 2:58 and Arthur Scargill still hadn't quite come into the camp because he was dealing with lots of interviews outside. Then he finally came in and then he had to go straight to his workshop and didn't have time for a BBC interview. And the BBC were like, like, we've been waiting here for ages, how dare you? Why can't we just, like, chase him? Why can't we,
we're
like,
the BBC.
Yeah, and please, can we... And it's like, ugh. So they were sort of hanging around and not sure what to do. And then at that very moment, suddenly the shout came out. Riot cops at the gate. Everything's happening. It's really kicking off. We need people up there right now. There's a real situation. There's cops coming in from all angles. And I'm there with the guy from the BBC. And he's like, what? Where? Brilliant. Ah! He's like running up the hill. And I'm like, but stop. You can't film that riot. It's outside the media hour. Come back here. And so, yeah, it was.
He didn't stop, did he?
No, he didn't stop. He really didn't stop. So at this point, we had to kind of get a bit creative with the policy. Because when I chased them up to the rear gate and it was obvious what was happening there and it was obvious the police were coming in really hard against people who were just sat on vehicles and, you know, the batons were out, the pepper spray was out. And actually, it was one of those snap decisions of this is no longer a normal situation. This is no longer the normal running of the camp. It may well be a good thing to have the BBC here. And they started filming anyway. I mean, it was like, I wasn't really able to stop them. So it was like, luckily, there was the cycle-powered microphone there. So I managed to grab that and go, everybody, be aware, the BBC is here. You know, so cover your face if you don't want to be on TV. Actually, and in the end, maybe it wasn't a bad thing they were there because it could well have stopped things from getting a lot nastier than they did. And obviously, they were pretty nasty anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And ultimately, the coverage they got was very, very clearly, and clearly us all just sat peacefully, you know, while the cops were just coming in really, really hard. And it was also quite good that it was just for once, it was from our side looking out. Because normally all the media coverage of this sort of stuff is that the camera's coming in with the cops. And, you know, and obviously got all the big sort of story from the cops first about, oh, this is a really dangerous thing. And then come charging in behind the cops. And you really can't, it looks like, you know, from that direction, it looks like they're for, you know, they're having a fight with some scary protesters. Whereas obviously from our side, it was really obvious that we were being completely peaceful and they were coming in really hard. And similar things were happening elsewhere on the camp. Some, you know, the people at the gate again had just gone, screw the media policy, we need the media in here, had flung the gate open and let the cameras in, and again, you know, quite understandable. And so other members of the media team were desperately running around the site trying to catch the journalists and kind of go, do we want to see that? Do we want to see this? Because again, there's like, in these situations, there's a real challenge between we want the media, if it's going to make the situation safer, and we want them to be able to show our side of the story so that it's not just they're getting it from the cops. But at the same time, we don't want all of the news that day to be police attacking the camp, because it's not the story we want to tell. We want to talk about climate change and coal.
And that's it's also not all that's happening.
And also it really has the risks putting people off coming to the camp if all the stories are about police violence. And the best thing to keep us safe and have a successful camp is to get as many people on this site as possible.
Yeah.
So trying to judge all this split second decisions. I remember, again, there was like one of my surreal moments of the day was like pursuing this BBC camera crew down the hill as they were running towards the other line of riot cops. And they were like, ah, let's go over here. And I was just like, please, can we just have a conversation about this first?
I need consensus.
Quick, we need a media meeting before you can film that, the riot cops hitting people. And I was sort of almost tempted to rugby tackle this kind of BBC reporter. It was sort of that situation of madness. But anyway, eventually, obviously things did calm down and just get to a bit more of a standoff, and the various TV crews that had got their footage. And again, it was really interesting talking to these reporters because most of them were shocked by what they'd seen, because they'd spent time. I mean, this is one of the advantages, I think, of the new media policy this year, is that all these journalists had actually spent a decent amount of time on the camp, going around, talking to people, realising that, you know, it was a completely peaceful, safe, happy place where loads of amazing stuff was happening, and then to see all these riot police just charging in for no reason at all.
Yeah, it's pretty out of context in the whole
completely
place.
So they were all a bit like, you know, this looks really bad for the cops and it looks quite good for you. So obviously you can't believe what the mainstream media say, but nonetheless, as it turned out, that was kind of reflected in the coverage that we got that day. We've got people on the outside who are basically very bravely for us watching all the TV and recording it, you know, which is an important role that someone has to do. The sense we got was, unfortunately, the story was all about the cops that day. But on the other hand, it was kind of saying, you know, the cops were out of order, the cops were being criticised, lots of people were criticising them all over the place. They were on the defensive for going over the top. Mm-hmm. And actually, it turned out to be quite fortunate that Norman Baker, the MP, was on site at that time. He was actually at that gate when everything was really going crazy. And he was standing there when someone just brought in a plate of food. I'm really happy.
I thought it was maybe Alan's second dinner, but it's for you.
No, I thought I'd miss the kitchens. That's awesome. Thank you. So the MP was there and was standing there watching like someone getting hit with a baton and pepper sprayed right next to him. And then the BBC were like, oh, look, there's Norman Baker, MP. Let's do an interview with him. and so again, he wasn't exactly complimentary about the policing either, which also, you know, worked in our favour, I think. So, you know, again, it was the whole good and bad. Good that it was on our side, but bad that it's not the story we want to tell. Yeah. It's not what
we're not
here
to fight the cops.
We're not here to fight the cops. We're not here to talk about the cops. We don't care about the cops. Yeah. We want to talk about climate change. We want to talk about the real issues. So, then the rest of the day, in comparison, wasn't quite as crazy, but was still fairly bizarre. because what happened then was that there, you know, there's a bit of a standoff going on. Arthur Scargill emerged from his workshop around this point. Mm-hmm. And there were still lots of media roaming around the site, and they were like, oh, let's interview Arthur Scargill. Scargill was like convinced that the cops had turned up just because it was his workshop.
Cops raid Scargill workshop.
Yeah. they just basically wanted to make sure he didn't have any audience, you know. Bless him.
Conspiracy.
He really, you know, does have that high an opinion of himself. Obviously it was like amazing having him there and amazing having him speaking, and you know, kind of a bit of a coup for us, and brilliant that he was able to start this kind of dialogue about, you know, the just transition to renewable power and blah blah blah. But then all the cameras descended and we had to try and shepherd them all down to the gate, and I find myself in the bizarre position of like having to, because no, he didn't actually know how he was getting home. So it was like, hang on a minute, I'm meant to be doing all these other things, but I've got to kind of arrange a taxi for Arthur Scargill. Which I'm sure wasn't really in the sort of list of things I had that I was going to be doing that day.
Did you not arrange to get him on a tandem bike or something?
Yeah, you could have got him on a bike. Bike library and bicycleology and stuff.
It would truly have been wonderful, but I don't know if he really would have gone for it at that moment. But anyway, he was interesting what he was saying to the media, because he was really complimentary about the camp, thought we were great, thought it was brilliant that we'd, like, you know, invited him on and was prepared to have a dialogue, even though all the stuff he was saying about New Coal was absolutely dreadful. nonetheless, I think it looked great for us that we, you know, we're prepared to have these dialogues and these discussions, and that mm-hmm. we're open-minded, and that, you know, we're happy to have people who disagree with us on the site and have those discussions. So then things moved on, and turned out Channel 4 News last night apparently was really good and had lots of interviews with people from the camp, and was quite a good balanced programme. Cool. And then today, it was interesting that generally, again, the media on site, we've been worried that all they want to talk about was the police, but it hasn't really been like that. You know, they always ask about the police stuff just to get it out of the way. And then they are talking about the other things. You know, the police stuff isn't really biting. The police have been dissed so much, essentially, by various people that generally the media aren't really believing them that much when, you know, they feel obliged to report it because mm-hmm. it's a story that the police are coming down hard on us. But yeah. They're not, you know, obviously this is kind of in the media we've been dealing with directly. You know, some of the, like, more liberal mainstream papers and stuff, in terms of, like, the Daily Mail and the Evening Standard, I mean, essentially we don't even bother looking at them, because we, it's just like, we're not going to learn anything useful from looking at those papers. We know they're just going to slate us whatever we do.
Playing the Eco Warrior record?
Yeah, I'm completely. It's like, who knows and who cares what they're saying? It's like, there's nothing we can do about it. Let's at least focus on the media that people that might actually come to the camp are going to read. Because right now the message is the camp is safe, the camp is happy, the camp is a great place to be. Everyone get down here. And that's what we've really been focusing on.
Cool.
So to sort of wrap up, the grand finale today, of course, was that the police decided to hold a press conference this morning and do a press release in which they said something along the lines of, we found a stash of knives and other dangerous items sort of near the climate camp in a tree. We've got no evidence that it's anything to do with the climate camp.
Did they say we were going to use them to stab horses?
It looks extremely suspicious.
Terrible.
It's proximate to the camp.
What the fuck does that mean?
In a 5-mile radius.
And yeah, so we suspect that somewhere on the camp there's a minority of dangerous troublemakers who are planning to stab police and horses and dogs.
Are the police here for our protection then?
And they essentially want to get on the site for our protection and our health and safety.
Have you told them we can take care of ourselves?
pretty much, yes. Essentially, like, of all the bizarre lines the police have been trotting out, they've been saying loads of stuff about, you know, they're concerned about health and safety on the site, and so they need to get on and check everything. Today, they, essentially, the local council were going to come on and do an inspection to check that the site was safe and healthy. Mm-hmm. The police refused to let them on. Which kind of...
For health and safety reasons.
And also, like, I mean, I'm sure people have heard all the pathetic things they've been saying about the back gate needed for emergency access, even though the fire department are told that it isn't, blah, 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 blah. One of my favourite ones is one of the cops was saying with a completely straight face as though he truly believed it, that because we're on Ministry of Defence land, there might be unexploded mines here.
Oh, wow, that's one we haven't heard yet.
I haven't heard that one yet.
You know, which, considering this was a field of sheep before we arrived...
Those poor sheep.
Exploding sheep.
Didn't actually notice any exploded bits of sheep around the field, so we're probably okay. But anyway, the police went out with this big media statement today saying there were knives and it was all really dangerous, and so, you know, it completely justified all of their policing methods the last couple of days.
When did they say they found the knives? Today, or
They said they found it late last night. Found them late last night, and you know they had the. So they released it all this morning. But again, it's been interesting to see that certainly the media have come on site, and fair enough, the media have come on site are the ones who are most interested. Oh, there's that lovely helicopter.
Yeah, our
again.
Friends in the sky are back.
Hooray! Here for our safety and protection, of course. So yeah, the media on site, obviously the media who are more interested in the camp and are probably a little bit more friendly. But again, they just really haven't been that interested in the story. It hasn't been getting that much traction in a lot of the media, you know, because okay. The police have been pretty discredited over the last couple of days. Again, I'm sure the Daily Mail are dancing around with glee and printing all sorts of stuff about it. But certainly a lot of the other broadsheets, you know, are being a bit more balanced about it. And the other sort of quite interesting media thing today was that Bob Marshall-Andrews, who's the local MP, came to sort of have a look at the site, because essentially what's been happening is Caroline Lucas MEP, who's obviously the Green Party MEP, John McDonnell, who's the MP for Heathrow, who the camp made some good links with last year, also Colin Challen MP, who's sort of quite a prominent MP in the government's climate change stuff that they're doing. And that's his official title, obviously.
Yeah.
And Chris Davies, who's an MEP, who's an interesting character. He's a Lib Dem MEP, and he's a sort of official European sort of liaison for carbon capture and storage technologies. And he's been very outspoken about the fact that these technologies are nowhere near ready, and said that new coal would be a disaster, and that if they started building a power station at King's North, he would come and join us on the barricades to stop it. So he's
a Lib Dem.
He's a Lib Dem, so he's an interesting chap. Okay, anyway, cool. the four politicians were writing a letter. Writing a letter to a sort of public letter to the government and to the police command, saying, you know, that they're, you know, not happy about the way the place has been policed. And Bob Marshall-Andrews had been asked to sign it, and he wasn't sure, so he came to inspect the site to find out. And essentially, it was taken on a tour by some of our wonderful campers, and at the end of it was like, this is just... He said something along the lines of, this is the safest I've ever felt in my life, being on this site. And he was just full of praise for the camp. Everyone involved thought we were completely amazing, and did a statement outside the gate to ITV News, sort of local news, just saying that the police's behaviour had been indefensible after everything he'd seen around here, and that he, again, as a local MP, has some influence and is going to go and speak rather sternly to the Gold Commander here. So again, that was another nice little bit of media that came out of the day. So although the police came out with their own sort of media offensive, they certainly haven't had it all their own way. And we did manage to get out a press release finally, eventually, when the power came on. And, so, you know, we await with bated breath how the rest of the TV's gone and what the newspaper's going to say tomorrow. So I guess, as a summary, media coverage so far, it's been all right, but it's mostly been kind of crisis management, really, trying to get the real story of the camp out there amidst all the guff about the police. And hopefully we've kind of held the fort. And things hopefully will get calmer for the next few days, and we'll be able to get some of the real issues out there. But one outcome will be that now we've become a news story, you know? In the same way that some of the stuff that happened last year made us a news story, even if it's not the way we want to be a news story, it's pushed us up the agenda so that now the media are more interested in us and what we're doing. So we might get some better coverage, really. But we have to really do our best to get some of the bigger issues out there. Also, we're really trying desperately to get a head-to-head debate between someone from the camp and either the head of E.ON or the energy minister, Malcolm Wicks, and so far they are refusing to do it.
That would be interesting.
They're very scared.
yeah.
So, the final thing is then just, it's completely crazy on the media team, and any volunteers, any people who want to join in, who may be listening, who want to get involved, it's a fascinating job. You end up having to kind of stay in touch with everything that's going on the camp all the time. But we're holding trainings every morning at 10 o'clock in the media tent for anyone who wants to kind of come and get involved. So please do.
Thanks very much, Danny. Hopefully we'll have you again to give us another roundup on things as they happen. Enjoy your dinner. You look like you're a hungry boy.
I will do.
Okay, so next up we've got some spoken word poetry from...
Friend.
From Friend.
And, yep.
So unfortunately there's a helicopter.
Yeah, and it's so unpeaceful and not we will go very on, nice you know? To listen to.
Okay,
but
here we go.
The show must go on.
I had to do. This was written at Heathrow last year. It's called Bring It On. The many-headed dragon will die if it is seen. It'll die from straight exposure. On this, we all are keen. It feeds on war and fear, inaction and self-doubt. If we can learn to lose these things, then we'll have some clout. Every time it strikes at us with the long arm of its laws, chinks appear in its defense. For us, these are the doors. So this is the way to slay the beast with love and human will. First make yourself into a snack, and then let it eat its fill. If we step through, we'll see the path that leads straight to its heart. Then from deep within its tummy, we'll make that dragon fart. So here within the arena, the world's eyes are cast, as all the heroes gathered for this war against the past. As a bright and cheery future is only steps away, so now's the time to turn our energies from hard work into play. Life is for fun and the cops are a joke. With love and with laughter, we'll make this beast choke. We'll pull its strings as it pulled ours, and we'll make that dragon dance. We'll make it jump and we'll make it jive, and then leap onto the lance. For love is our armor, love, courage, will and guile. Love, courage, will for tooth and claw, and guile for the bile. Then from deep inside we'll emerge, born freshly to the light, knowing no more enemies, we'll no longer have to fight. So this is the way it's all meant to be, as the love of all life is our city's key. It's the key to the heart, the key to the mind. It'll unshackle the unicorn, and peace we will find. As for the lion, on dead dragon will dine, consuming its master, well, all but the spine. Then with the lamb, the lion will sleep. All this to me is faith's greatest leap. And this was penned in Parliament Square, and it's kind of a little bit of where we're at. Carbon paper junkies, dosh for distraction, like experimental monkeys, primed for reaction. Living in fear of bleak revolution, too scared to take steps towards evolution. Treading the mill as the future we grind, whilst finding the tools to open the mind. Recycling the spanners sent to break the draconian laws as change we make. There's twisted terms and laws just will, made by serpent worms and carried by Bill. Most pretend sheep are scared of the bite, but fear is the toxin that keeps endless night. Filled with the nightmares of dismembered pain, see how we're channeled by a pull on the rein. Driven down roads all leading to hell, less chance to turn as each tree we fell. We burn tomorrow, throw it away, not knowing borrow, stealing through play. So here's how we change the ways of the past, face up to a future that seems so vast. We must learn to be one, not all separate parts. We must shine like the sun and open our hearts. We must recognize skills and allow them to fuse. We must make all life the winner, as through no life we lose. Rewrite the rule, break free the chain. Don't play the fool, set democracy's reign. We can't let it all go or place our heads in the sand.
Sooner or later, we must make our last stand, or darkness will fall on this life that we share, our children's investment, our love and our care. So gently we'll show, with hearts full of peace, as the cogs and the wheels with love we will grease. Change the machine, program rewrite, learn to live green and put it all right. Respect all the life of our earthen home, with heart and mind love, with flesh and with bone. Learn to trust in yourself, you know what you need. Grow political freedom from democracy's seed. Everyone equal, no one person's control. No bad rules for the masses, or war's sad death toll. For yourself vote, as only you know. Learn how to float, help all life to grow. Then as peace radiates out across the seas and the land, we will at last see the path that was planned. A path that to a place for the promotion of love, a home for all life and God above. A place that is filled with forests of dreams, rejoicing with laughter as each soul mirror gleams.
Okay, thanks very much, friend. That will conclude tonight's broadcast, which went on longer than it was supposed to. But I guess it's making up for the show earlier that was shorter than it was supposed to be. So I think for the day, we actually came out with the right amount of stuff. Somehow, I don't know how it happens. But anyway, I would just like to say to anyone, we just want to give out the media dispatch number. So you can actually call this number, record an interview using your phone, and then we can access that. Different people can access that. So if you're actually in a situation where you don't have a recorder, but you think that an interview would be appropriate, get information, get it out there. If there's something happening, get the information out there. The number is 0207-0433-783. So that's 0207-0433-783. You come to one of their menus where it says, if you want to do this, press 1.